This is Clinical Conversations. I'm Joe Elia from the NEJM Group. Last week, a story in The Guardian about the CIA's longstanding rules for human research caught my eye. The rules state that the agency should not conduct research on human subjects, quotes, except in accordance with guidelines issued by the Department of Health and Human Services, end quote, including, of course, the subject's informed consent. Taken together with the revelations from the report last December of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence about the agency's use of what are called enhanced interrogation techniques, the issue of medical ethics, specifically the complicity of clinicians and the use of these interrogation techniques, comes to the fore. I've reached out to Dr. Scott Allen, a professor of medicine at the University of California, Riverside, and a medical advisor to the group Physicians for Human Rights, for his thoughts on the issue. Dr. Allen helped write an analysis of the Senate report on torture titled Doing Harm, Health Professionals' Central Role in the CIA Torture Program. Welcome, Dr. Allen.
Thank you.
We're talking about more than just informed consent here, aren't we?
Absolutely. There's a the broader topic is, in my mind, the issue of medical professionalism. And as such, it's a topic that I think should be of interest to all who practice medicine.
You know, the agencies, the Central Intelligence Agency's Office of Medical Services, instructed that every waterboarding, according to the Senate report, be thoroughly documented. So I guess that's and they were using that information to titrate the number of times they would waterboard somebody or how effective waterboarding was. So I guess in that sense, people have pointed out that they were collecting data and therefore, everything else aside, they were doing human experimentation. And we can only assume that they didn't get any signatures before they did these procedures.
Well, I would say they didn't get any IRB approval, so far as we're aware.
Okay.
They certainly did get approval, though, and these activities were not only authorized, but they were required by the government through memos drafted by the White House's Office of Legal Counsel.
Right, and those memos are extensive and actually use the fact that that clinicians were involved in these enhanced interrogation techniques as a proof that it wasn't torture, really, because there was a clinician nearby who could help out.
That's correct, and that's really an important point to understand that it's not simply that medical professionals were complicit and involved with the U.S. torture program. If you really understand how the program evolved, they were essential to it. They helped design it. And as you just pointed out, were critical, in fact, essential to justifying it legally, even though that legal opinion has now been revoked and is discredited. But nonetheless, the program went forward because medical professionals were willing to support it in contradiction to established medical ethics.
It came home to me at one point, kind of a smoking gun of complicity, when I read about the medical officer's recommendation that Khaled Sheikh Mohammed's next waterboarding session be conducted with saline because he had ingested so much water up to that point that the clinician feared hyponatremia or, electrolyte imbalance. And I thought, how do you say those words?
Now, that's just one of many particularly stunning things to read about, where the few areas where we know some details of health professionals overseeing torture sessions. And it also brings up another point that I like to emphasize. I've been looking at this issue of physician complicity in torture for over a decade, and prior to doing that, I worked for nearly a decade in prisons, full-time doing prison health. And when September 11th happened, in fact, I watched the planes from inside a prison on television. I was already aware of the inherent conflicts. for doctors who work in confined settings and answer to a security chain of command, and became concerned already right off the bat once the country went back to war about the conflicts, ethical conflicts that would face physicians who had to treat war detainees. As the story unfolded, I initially worried that physicians would be in the awkward position of seeing evidence of maltreatment and be challenged to report it and intervene. Little did I expect as I researched the topic over the last 10 years that I would find what we've been describing, that medical professionals were there at the creation and all the way through and were essential to the deployment and legal justification of this program. What we learned from that Senate report that you referred to that had caught your recent attention was really more chilling detail about the level of participation. I think one of the things that was new with that Senate report that we had not been previously aware is the use of something called rectal hydration and rectal feeding. These were interventions where tubes were placed in the rectum of the individuals being interrogated under medical supervision, or really more medical participation. It was doctors placing these tubes to infuse the subject with either fluids or formula, and supposedly with the justification for hydration or feeding, when in those cases there were alternative methods that were not as humiliating. If you read the actual accounts and notations of the doctors, they're rather clear that they were doing this to coerce and punish the people who are being interrogated. So this is just in complete opposition to established ethics.
Yeah, there was a point in your analysis that you point out, PHR points out that rectal feeding of pureed food has no nutritional value. Because the large intestine won't absorb those nutrients, and in fact, it was done in one of the I don't know where I read the passage, either in your analysis or in the Senate report, but it was done to spite, I think it was Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, and to enforce their dominance over him.
Absolutely correct.
Yeah.
The if you taken together the so-called enhanced interrogation procedures or methods, all were about disrupting the personality and breaking the individual down psychologically. It was psychological torture as much, if not more, than it was physical torture, and every one of those techniques, if you look at them, are really about infringing on the autonomy or sense of autonomy of the subject. So it's restricting them in any variety of ways. And the sad thing about waterboarding is it's even controlling their breathing. And there's a lot of dietary manipulation, various forms of assault that are both cultural and sexual. Certainly the rectal feeding and hydration falls into that category. So it's all about breaking down the individuals. There's no question about it. The intent of all of these techniques was to inflict pain, suffering, and harm with the aim to break them down. By the way, even though I'm concerned about this as a physician, I should say that among professional interrogators, there's no evidence that that approach is valid in terms of an intelligence gathering approach. But even if it were, as a physician, we should be totally opposed to to begin with, and certainly, absolutely, draw a bright line and say there's no way physicians should ever support these activities.
Well, I guess the American public is getting a kind of education, a counter-education to your recommendations with the Program 24. And Jack Bauer, a friend of mine, points out that they often torture people, and torture works. And I said, well, it works on television, but
it's such a good point. And all I would say to that, I've struggled with that. I think there's even been some journalism accounting that people, even in the White House, were referring to Jack Bauer in 24 in support of their argument on why we should employ torture. But I'd just like to say this. This has been a story that's been very discouraging in terms of ethics and illegality. But to me, as a professional, it's also a story about incompetence. I think if you look at this whole story and see how often the science was misrepresented or twisted, you have to ask yourself if the science of, say, a weapon system were so twisted and what they delivered, the system didn't function or function as advertised and harm occurred, there'd be an outcry. And the public would understand that that was incompetence.
Yeah.
Yet what we did here is deliver scientific incompetence, not only unethical, but did not follow any of the evidence about whether these things were not only proper, but would they work. And what we got as a result is something that was terribly costly, not only to the people who were subjected to this, who are very likely to suffer lifelong post-traumatic stress and other complications, but to everyone who's involved in it. I mean, I think there's also been a growing number of accounts of people who were asked or sent, really not asked, they were ordered to do these things, who have suffered terribly racked by their consciences in the years that follow.
There was a report from Physicians for Human Rights about I think it was a physician's assistant in Guantanamo who refused. I may be misremembering.
That's a nurse. I know the case you're talking about. And that, to me, was a very significant... The nurse, to my knowledge, remains unnamed. Someone's obviously in active duty, so the discussion has occurred generically. I thought that was a very significant thing, and I obviously, from my position, salute the nurse for their courage to assert professional principles. I don't know that doctors have not also done the same thing, but let me put it this way. After 10 years of studying, I am unaware of a doctor stepping in and saying, I refuse to do it. Mm. There's some accounts, if you read through the Senate report, of doctors expressing concerns, but then it's not clear that they didn't ultimately follow through with the order or the directive. So I think it was a very courageous stand, and it brings me back to the issue I mentioned at our at the opening of our discussion, that is, of professionalism. You might say, why should doctors in the community and civilian practice care about this discussion? And I think it all comes back to professionalism. And there's some key elements of professionalism, and one of them, only one of them, is ethics. But the ethics part is important in distinguishing professions like medicine from any other skilled trade. You know, mm-hmm. We're not plumbers. We're not electricians. We have to earn and keep the public trust so that when we violate our own ethics and we do so under pressure, say, from the government, and the government may have a legitimate interest, as clearly, certainly, and broadly speaking, the government did in this case, if we are willing to bend under that sort of pressure, the public would rightly question how trustworthy are we, with... providing care and protecting their interests where we might be pressured by the government or other entities in other situations.
Yeah.
I think it's really essential that the profession define what is ethical behavior and defend and follow that.
You know, you at the end of this report, Doing Harm, makes several specific recommendations, one of them asking for a federal commission to investigate and refer violations of law to the Department of Justice. What response has Physicians for Human Rights received either from the White House or the Congress or other bodies?
Well, mostly silence, which has not been atypical. We've released earlier reports and made similar requests in the past. You know, I think the frustrating thing to those of us who care about this issue is that there really hasn't been any real accountability for the bad decisions that were made with the deployment of this program. And I have to be honest, I have some interest in individual accountability, but that's not what really drives me. I think that we need, as a country, to have some sort of, you might say, truth and reconciliation type of process to have an open and candid discussion about what went wrong here and how we prevent it from happening again in the future.
Although there was somebody from the UN who said that you can't forgive torture,
Yeah, absolutely correct. I agree with that, but as, you know, certainly looking at the South African example as some precedent, I don't think anyone in that process was necessarily forgiving all that came before, but it was this sort of practical process to at least get through as a society some of the awful things that had transpired.
And, well, one of the things that's at work here, and Glenn Greenwald points this out in his book With Liberty and Justice for Some. He argues that since both major political parties are complicit, investigations such as the one that you have proposed are unlikely. Would you agree?
Well, my observation and my thought on that is that, yes, in the short term, it becomes highly unlikely. I have said that probably, looking at historic precedent, we have to wait to the people that might be embarrassed or were implicated in this process or at least out of office, or if it takes even longer, until they're no longer among us. However, having said that, we can't, you know, acquiesce to that. We can't stop putting pressure. Let me tell you about one instance where continued pressure by my colleagues has resulted in some investigation. Of the professional associations, the American Psychological Association, that's the Association of Psychologists, we have been reporting through PHR and through other venues, really for a number of years, we've been describing our impression that the APA was overly accommodating to the intelligence infrastructure in U.S. government, both Department of Defense and CIA, and we believed they helped grease the skids, so to speak, and helped enable the torture program, whether they intended to or not. And our continuing allegations eventually resulted in the APA appointing an independent investigation. They appointed a attorney named Hoffman and his law firm and gave them access to all of their files and said, you do an independent investigation and let us know if we've done anything wrong. Now, that report should be coming out in coming weeks or months as we speak today. I think that is an important process because, to my knowledge, it's really the first sort of independent investigation. Obviously, we're talking today about the Senate report, too, which was a critically important report, but as we know, that was not released in its entirety. A heavily redacted summary was released.
Yeah. What other documents besides, say, the PHA's doing harm might clinicians read to inform themselves about these issues?
Well, I think the PHR references are a good place to start. So the report you reference, which is available on Physicians for Human Rights website, is only the most recent in a series of reports that date back over 10 years. Mm-hmm. I think there have been five or six of them to date. The vast majority I was involved with the drafting or writing or editing of, and I think collectively they tell an important story. Another good reference, though, was done by a task force chaired out of Columbia University's Medicine as a Profession program that came out a couple years ago, looking specifically at the role of health professionals in torture, and also, you know, describes a similar set of findings.
Okay. Well, that's good. Anything else? Is there you mentioned earlier that you were hoping that clinicians would learn the lesson of professionalism and how that applies here. Is there anything else that a working clinician should take from what you've been working on?
Well, you know, having worked in prisons and also in state mental institutions and other sort of what I might call extraordinary or challenging clinical environments, I often say the things I've learned in those extreme settings are always applicable when I return to the general community. The main message I think the average doctor working in the community should take from this discussion is to remind themselves that their license and their profession is something to be carefully guarded. And whether it's an insurance company or a police officer arriving in your office or any sort of other outside authority with an agenda, while as good citizens, of course, we want to cooperate, always check against your own profession's moral compass and make sure you're not going outside the line. Because if you don't protect that, I can tell you no one else will.
Hmm. Oh, that's good advice. Thanks so much, Dr. Allen, for spending time with me today.
Well, I thank you for your attention to the topic.
That was Clinical Conversations podcast number 178. I invite your comments and rejoinders at my email address, which is jelia@nejm.org. We come to you through the NEJM group. My executive producer is Kristen Kelly. Thanks so much for listening.